The world witnessed the strength and resolve of our new president. North Korea would do well not to test his resolve.
A strong warning for North Korea. It's Tuesday, April 18th. This is VOA Asia. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We're online right now as well on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, Malaysia and China at odds in the South China Sea. China's economy still expanding. We plug into technology in Cambodia. Walking on plastic bottles. We begin our journey now on VOA Asia. U.S. Vice President Mike Pence has issued a strong warning to North Korea while visiting South Korea Monday. Referencing recent U.S. airstrikes in Syria and Afghanistan, he said President Donald Trump will use military force, if needed, to deal with the Kim Jong-un government's escalating nuclear threat.
Just in the past 2 weeks, the world witnessed the strength and resolve of our new president in actions taken in Syria and Afghanistan. North Korea would do well not to test his resolve.
The vice president is visiting South Korea at the beginning of a four-nation Asia tour to reinforce the U.S. commitment to allies in this increasingly volatile region and to build international support for increasing pressure on the North to end its nuclear and ballistic missile development programs. During a press conference in Seoul Monday with South Korea's acting president, Hwang Kyo-an, Pence stressed the unshakable U.S. commitment to defend its long-standing ally and cooperate on all decisions regarding regional security.
We will continue to closely consult with South Korea and your leadership as we make decisions moving forward.
The Trump administration is reportedly focusing on tougher economic sanctions, possibly including an oil embargo, a global ban on North Korea's airline, intercepting cargo ships, and punishing Chinese banks doing business with Pyongyang. The vice president reiterated Trump's recent praise for China's increased enforcement of economic sanctions that included sending back cargo ships full of coal, one of the North's most lucrative exports, and canceling some airline flights into Pyongyang. While China supports UN sanctions to pressure North Korea into nuclear disarmament talks, it has been reluctant to harshly implement measures that might produce instability at its border and increase U.S. power in the region. Vice President Pence mentioned Washington is not pleased with Chinese actions against South Korea.
The United States is troubled by China's economic retaliation against South Korea for taking appropriate steps to defend itself.
Many in South Korea have grown concerned that the U.S. might take unilateral military action against North Korea that could plunge the region into war. In New York, meanwhile, North Korea's deputy U.N. ambassador Kim In-rong held a hastily called news conference in which he said was intended to condemn a meeting to be held in the U.N. Security Council at the end of April. The United States is the council president this month, and the meeting on the 28th will be chaired by Secretary of State Rex Tillerson with a focus on North Korea's nuclear proliferation. Much of his comments focused on the current tensions on the Korean Peninsula and the recent U.S. missile strike on Syria to retaliate for that government's use of chemical weapons against civilians there. He also complained about the annual U.S.-South Korean joint military exercises that are currently taking place, a favorite source of outrage by Pyongyang.
It is crystal clear to everybody the United States, hell-bent on the dangerous cyber rattling in South Korea, little short of a nuclear arsenal, is arch-criminal harassing the peace and stability on the Korean Peninsula and the rest of Northeast Asia.
The vice president's visit to South Korea comes at a time of heightened tensions over North Korea's defiant efforts to ultimately develop a nuclear-tipped intercontinental ballistic missile capable of reaching the U.S. mainland and the Trump administration's determination to prevent that from happening. Trump has talked tough about stopping North Korea and last week sent the USS Carl Vinson nuclear-powered aircraft carrier into the region in response to evidence that North Korea was preparing to conduct a nuclear test during the celebration of the birthday of the nation's founding father, Kim Il-sung. Pyongyang did not conduct the test over the weekend, but it did hold a massive military parade on Saturday that exhibited some new long-range and submarine-based missiles. On Sunday, it attempted to test a medium-range missile, which exploded seconds after it was launched. Our Seoul correspondent is Brian Patton, and with help from Yumi Kim, we thank them for sending us the story. These are among some of the top Asia stories trending on VOANews.com. Pence warns North Korea not to test U.S. resolve. North Korea snubbed Chinese diplomats, according to a report. McMaster concludes Pakistan talks with call to confront terrorism. China's economy gains steam. First quarter growth is the fastest since 2015. Rohingya child disappearances spark trafficking fears. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and more on Facebook at VOA Asia and on our VOANews.com website. VOA Asia continues. The discovery of new and persistent Chinese Coast Guard activity in a tract of sea claimed by Malaysia is adding public pressure on the Southeast Asian government to resist China, but is so far not seen as a tipping point in relations. The Asia Maritime Transparency Initiative under the U.S. think tank Center for Strategic and International Studies says three Chinese Coast Guard vessels patrolled waters off the Malaysian coast of Borneo from December through late February. Analysts like Colin Koh, Marine Security Research Fellow at the Nanyang Technical University in Singapore, says that will add public pressure on the Malaysian government of Prime Minister Najib Razak to step up resistance against China.
I think certainly these issue will become a sticking point for Najib. He wouldn't want to put foreign policy on the center stage because this is going to become a particularly problematic issue that he will find very hard to deal with.
The think tank initiative's website says China's boats and one Malaysian Coast Guard vessel, apparently tracking the Chinese, were found near Luconia Shoals. In 2015, the country spotted a Chinese Coast Guard ship anchored at the same shoals, which are tiny South China Sea landforms in the Malaysian Maritime Exclusive Economic Zone, about 100 kilometers north of Malaysia's Sarawak State on the island of Borneo. The American think tank says the vessel spotted at that time had been there since 2013. In March 2016, Malaysia spotted 100 Chinese fishing boats escorted by Beijing's Coast Guard. Malaysia usually avoids confronting Beijing because of tight economic relations between the two nations. Malaysia counts China, the world's second largest economy, as its top trading partner and biggest source of direct foreign investment. Jonathan Spangler is director of the South China Sea think tank in Taipei.
For Malaysia, which has sought to maintain friendly relations with China, publicly condemning Chinese actions would disrupt that delicate balance and could have serious economic and other repercussions. For China, it has demonstrated that it's willing and able to increasingly securitize its claimed territories, but overdoing it could eventually provide rival claimants the impetus for mustering a united regional response.
Prime Minister Najib Razak's coalition faces tough elections before the end of 2018 as Malaysia grapples with economic issues such as inflation and weak consumption. The U.S. think tank's initiative says Beijing's near-constant presence at Luconia Shoals does not garner much attention, but it does speak to Beijing's determination to establish administrative control throughout the so-called nine-dash line. The submerged oil-rich shoals are 2,000 kilometers from China, and they fall within Beijing's nine-dash line claim to more than 90% of the 3.5 million square kilometer South China Sea. The sea is contested all or in part by Malaysia and four other governments. Asian nations have pursued it for abundance of fisheries, marine shipping lanes, and fossil fuel reserves under the seabed. Malaysia is the biggest prospector of oil and gas. Oh Ai-soon, international studies instructor at Singapore Nanyang University, says compared to people in Vietnam and the Philippines, which also vie with China over parts of the sea, Malaysians tend to be more focused on domestic issues rather than foreign vessels offshore.
For Malaysian, I think it's primarily because we are really blessed with a lot of natural resources. For people who are sort of inward-looking, they don't quite pay a lot of attention to this sort of international matters, even if it happens in the surrounding waters.
Analysts say China is careful to avoid sparking strong protests as it tries to lock in its maritime claims. A dispute over Scarborough Shoal near the Philippines in 2012 prompted Manila to file for a World Court of Arbitration hearing. An arbitration tribunal ruled in favor of the Philippines in July. That's a decision Beijing called a farce. Meanwhile, China has offered economic incentives elsewhere in Southeast Asia in exchange for tolerance of its maritime expansion, enticing Malaysia's neighbor Brunei and, more recently, the Philippines. Thanks to Ralph Jennings in Taipei for bringing us this story. Happening now in Asia, U.S. Vice President Mike Pence reaffirmed Washington's past policy of strategic patience toward North Korea is over. The vice president said the U.S. will not tolerate further missile or nuclear tests. He highlighted recent U.S. strikes in Syria and Afghanistan as proof of Washington's resolve. Stay up to date with VOA Asia on Facebook. We're always glad to have you with us on VOA Asia. Thanks for joining us today. China's economy expanded 6.9% in the first quarter, buoyed by government spending and a hot property market. The growth rate exceeded analysts' expectations, represented the fastest quarterly performance since the third quarter of 2015, and followed last year's 6.7% growth rate. Tim Condon, chief economist at ING in Singapore, tells VOA's Victor Beatty he gives high marks to Chinese policymakers, as well as improving U.S. economic conditions for the improvement.
The authorities have done a fantastic job. They've managed to soft land the economy. They've managed to slow credit growth. They're working on reducing leverage in the financial system. And they do have a problem in the property market, but they seem determined to take care of that. And I think I wouldn't bet against them.
We've been witnessing the last 3 years slowing growth in the world's second biggest economy. What do you attribute the turnaround to?
Part of it is policy driven. They did soften policy toward housing in 2014. That's borne fruit in 2015 and 2016 and continues to do so this year in terms of home price increases and housing activity. A little bit too much of a good thing, it looks like. There's another thing I'd like to highlight, though, which is I think what's going on in the global economy is kind of an old school U.S. spending-driven recovery. We see a real pickup in U.S. trade growth, import growth in the fourth quarter of last year. That strength has continued in January, February of this year. That has translated into quite strong Asian export growth. And we saw last week in China's March trade data that strength continued. So a lot of it is concentrated in the mobile phone sector of manufacturing, telecom equipment, disproportionate driver of export growth. And it'd be nice to see that broadening out. But I think that some of the strength of manufacturing is coming from this exports to the U.S.-led growth.
And, of course, that dovetails with the figures for March. Factory output increasing 7.6%. That's year-on-year, the fastest pace in over 3 years. And also, fixed asset investment grew 9.2% in the first quarter. What does that mean?
The drivers here are coming from the property market and infrastructure. You know, what we thought would happen this year was, or at least what I thought would happen this year, was that the property sector would cool off because of the macroprudential policies, and that would be replaced by manufacturing. That so far hasn't really been the story. It's been a continuation of what we saw last year, very strong sustained growth in infrastructure investment and the property market also, real estate investment also doing very well, being the big drivers of fixed asset investment growth. So the turn I expected to happen has not happened.
Tim Condon said eventually he expects policies to slow down the property investment market will begin to take hold. And while Chinese officials expected growth to be about 6.5% this year, Condon thinks the first quarter performance may nudge that higher to about 6.6%. You're listening to VOA Asia.
News happens around the clock. And VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock on the Voice of America. hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
This news alert from VOA Asia. The Chinese Foreign Ministry again voiced Beijing's opposition to deployment of the U.S. THAAD missile system in South Korea. China says the anti-ballistic missile system is a threat to its security. The United States and South Korea say THAAD is needed to defend against North Korea. All the big stories come your way throughout the day on VOA Asia Facebook. As we continue with VOA Asia, the Voice of America broadcasts in over 40 languages around the globe. Today, we begin a new series profiling some of our VOA journalists. Seofat Sung is a reporter for VOA's Khmer service, and he recently completed a four-month assignment reporting on technology trends in Cambodia, and he shared what he found with VOA Asia's Steve Miller, who first wanted to know how Seofat prepared for his assignment.
I didn't quite know like how to exactly prepare for that, but I think past travel experience helped me with that. So I have some family in the Bay Area, but most importantly, I have family in Phnom Penh. So I'm from Phnom Penh originally, so my family is there. And then past work I've done with the Khmer service is going back to Phnom Penh. So I didn't like have to bring my whole house in D.C. Mm-hmm. In fact, I still had to rent out.
Well, see, that's one of the big questions I have is that, okay, so you're leaving and you have a place here that you're coming back to. So how do you do that?
So logistically, I mean, you just pay rent. I mean, you know, and unfortunately, you have to do that.
Do you put out notices to all your friends? Hey, I'm going away for a few months. Do you know anyone who's coming to Washington that wants a nice place to stay?
I sort of thought about that. So, you know, my building doesn't allow subleasing. They didn't allow, but it's okay. You know, like you make up for the experience that you will have. This was the first time I was able to be in Cambodia for that long a period. Mm-hmm. And, as you said, as I told you earlier, I didn't really know how to prepare for that. Logistically, it's fine, you know, I think. And then the other interesting thing was like you said, how much do you pack? And maybe you can relate to this. As you travel more often, you realize there's this must bring along. What's ironic, actually, is it turned out to be that I packed less than in previous trips where I was actually there shorter.
I found that as well because I used to be a university professor, so I would have 10 weeks vacation in between semesters. So my wife and I would always travel around, and we would typically only bring a week's worth of clothes and just do laundry much more frequently than, say, even when we are here. But you talk about the must-have things you have. For us, it was a power strip because a lot of hotel rooms or different places we would stay in would have one or two plugs. And in today's society, with your smartphones, with your cameras, with your tablets, you quickly exceed that. And you have to have some kind of PowerPoint that can fit all your devices all at once. So what was your must-have thing?
I mean, must-have is passport and travel document.
Of course. That goes without saying.
But I'd had bad experience in not preparing that first.
Oh.
In previous times. And then you sort of couldn't find your passport like 3 hours before you leave the house. Things like that. I think my must-have is now the laptop. And you know, I work in digital. And now I realize that digital really allows you to condense things, you know. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to be a minimalist as well. I think that helps. And I think packing-wise, you know, I have family there, so I didn't have to bring too much. And usually what I do is just buy stuff that I need over there. I mean, the place I go, Cambodia, was not, you know, a place where things weren't accessible. So my basics, I think, are covered. The harder part was to prepare for work because that was new and that was a bit unprecedented. I have two colleagues who went on the rotation before me, but their focus was slightly different. They're more experienced journalists. They've traveled and have done these things before. For me, what is new is I do more lately I cover technology, so that's my new beat. And that was the big opportunity for me to do something with that. And so my goal for this was to work on a series on what I call Digital Cambodia, basically mapping out the landscape of the emerging
technology.
Tech sector that's happening there and just figuring out the main trends. But even that was hard to prepare for.
Well, there's a whole lot more, and you'll be able to hear it from Steve and Sofat's conversation this week as they talk technology and how Cambodia is changing. Developing at this hour in Asia, prosecutors in South Korea indicted former President Park Geun-hye on bribery, extortion, abuse of power, and other corruption charges. If convicted, Park could be sentenced to life in prison. A powerful corporate ally of Park was also indicted. VOA Asia keeps you informed all day on Facebook at VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, your next pair of shoes may come from a plastic bottle. Each day, millions of Americans drink purified water and other beverages from disposable plastic bottles. More than 60 million of those bottles are dumped into landfills or burned in incinerators daily. VOA's Deborah Block tells us a couple of American entrepreneurs are putting some of them to good use by recycling them into shoes.
These may be the world's most eco-friendly manufactured shoes. A San Francisco startup is using recycled plastic water bottles to create fashionable women's footwear called Rothy's.
We sterilize those bottles, hot wash them, they get chipped into flake, and then they're extruded into a very soft filament fiber.
Those fibers are placed into a 3D knitting machine designed to minimize waste during the shoe assembly. Then, the knitted fabric and insole are attached to the shoe's outer sole, made from responsibly sourced no-carbon rubber. Rothy's are sold online. After American actress Gwyneth Paltrow discovered them last year, the demand for the shoes grew.
We're not going to run out of water bottles anytime soon, so we've got an infinite supply of material, and I think that bodes well for our future.
Once the environmentally friendly shoes wear out, they can be returned free of charge to a company that uses the recycled materials to turn them into other products. Deborah Block, VOA News, Washington.
April is Parkinson's Disease Awareness Month, and even though scientists have been studying the condition for 200 years, there's still no cure. Researchers in Britain have shown genetic manipulation can prevent or slow the symptoms of Parkinson's in the inherited form of the disease. Although that only applies to a minority of Parkinson's patients, Faith Lapidus reports researchers are learning more about what causes nerve cells in the brain to die.
Parkinson's disease is a progressive neurological disorder that affects the way the brain connects with muscles. It's caused by the death of nerve cells in the brain, which leads patients to gradually lose control of their movements, their speech, and their cognitive functions. To learn how genes and their mutations affect that process, scientists at the University of Leicester are looking at Drosophila, better known as fruit flies.
We are interested in what causes this loss of neurons, and we use the fruit fly to model the early events associated with neuronal death.
The researchers are focusing on mitochondria, the cell's power plant.
We have found that a particular organelle, mitochondria, which are the energy power packs inside cells, are defective in Parkinson's disease brains. And we found ways to re-energize these mitochondria, and re-energizing mitochondria in Drosophila brains rescues or restores neuronal health.
They've identified the gene that switches the power on and off, but their work is still a long way from having significance for Parkinson's patients.
Our findings do not mean that we have found a cure for Parkinson's disease, but we are hopeful that some of the agents that we have found to protect neurons in Parkinson's disease models can eventually be applied in humans to delay the onset of a disease like this.
So, 200 years after Parkinson's disease was identified, research and hope continues. I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
The advancements are absolutely amazing, and you can continue to follow them on VOA Asia. We thank you for listening. Don't forget, you can find our program many different ways. Two of them include iTunes and SoundCloud. We're also on Facebook at VOA Asia. We'd like to thank our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jonah Cummings, managing editor, Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team, including Steve Miller and Ali Ogden. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We hope you have a wonderful day.